Like the conversations you hear on Basic Folk with your favorite roots artists? Then join Back Catalog Listening Party, a weekly podcast where you can dig deeper into their catalog. Top songwriters like Mary Gaucher, Chris Smither, Dar Williams, and Lizzie Ngo join host Mother Banjo and Anthony Earig to talk about their old albums with a live online audience. Listen wherever you get your podcasts and learn about attending live tapings at backcataloglisteningparty.com/join. Hi, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. I'm Cindy Howes, and I host this podcast. Thanks for checking out the show today. Very exciting times today on Basic Folk as we welcome Kathleen Parks from Twisted Pine. Before we get into our special guest, let's talk about our mailing list. Are you on our mailing list? It's a once-a-month email that comes into your inbox and keeps you updated on what Basic Folk is doing, who's been on the podcast recently, who's coming up, and how we feel about all of it. There's a link in the show notes to sign up for the mailing list, or you can go to basicfolk.com. You can also follow us on social media. We are at Basic Folk Pod on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. You can also make a contribution to Basic Folk. You can send us $1. You can send us $1,000. You can send us $5 a month. Anything you do really helps to keep us going. It's fun to make Basic Folk, but it's not free. Anyways, if you are interested in helping out, I know a lot of people are asking listeners and fans of things to pitch them money. If you can, it's awesome. If you can't do it, it's no big deal. But maybe something that you could do is send this episode to somebody that you think will enjoy the podcast. That's also a great way to support us. If you want to make a contribution, you can go to the link in the show notes or basicfolk.com. All right. Hot off the heels of Twisted Pine's latest release, Love Your Mind, Kathleen Parks is here to dig into her uncelebrated polka origins. Daughter of the well-renowned trumpetist Eric Parks, the younger Parks grew up in New York's Hudson Valley in a very creative family. Her mother was also a dancer and the one who made Kathleen practice all the time. She started young on the violin and was surrounded by her dad's polka music playing as he was a member of the Jimmy Sturs Orchestra, which my dad, also a polka head, calls
the top polka band revered by all polka bands.
She even sat in with the band as a teen when she would occasionally fill in for the violin player. Parks fully embraced her strong Irish roots not only in music, but also dance, which she calls her second love. After accepting a full scholarship to Berklee College of Music in Boston, she started meeting and jamming with bluegrass musicians in the area, especially at the Cantam Lounge, famous for its weekly bluegrass night. This is where her friends in her new band, Twisted Pine, scored a residency and started building a following. On the new record, Kathleen is the de facto singer, which she's just fine with. She also explains the band in one sentence, "Let's see what happens," which is definitely present on the new record, filled with wild vocal performances, but sees the band operating at its highest level. We explore the mental health themes highlighted in the song After Midnight, Nothing Good Happens, which is about how difficult it can be to take care of yourself on the road. It's hard to eat healthy and exercise, but it's also hard to go to bed at a reasonable hour. Plus, we finally find out what a good time one should go to bed at fiddle camp. It's always earlier than you think. Let's listen to that song we were just talking about, After Midnight, Nothing Good Happens, from Twisted Pine, and then we'll get to our conversation with Kathleen Parks on Basic Folk.
Nothing good happens after midnight, unless you pick until dawn. And even then you lose time and sleep. You forget you gotta brush your teeth just to pick a country song. Well, I've been here at this bluegrass festival since early this morning. But all that late night good times calling you.
All right, Kathleen Parks, let's do this. This has been a long time coming. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm so honored to be here.
Oh, well, me too. I also feel honored. Okay, let's talk about Goosebumps. The first single from Twisted Pine's Love Your Mind record is Goosebump Feeling. I went to your personal website and there is a huge quote about your voice being goosebump inducing. Just thinking about other famous goosebump things in our lives. Perhaps you are an R.L. Stein Goosebumps fan. I don't know. But let's start here. What's been your experience with goosebumps throughout your life?
My experience with goosebumps. Well, you know, I guess the first thing that I'm just going to say what pops into my mind immediately is that my growing up, we would say goosebumps, but my grandmother used to say she would get chicken bumps when something would freak her out. Sorry, that is so random and not at all exactly what the song is about, but that for some reason, that's the first thing that comes to mind.
That's such a cute grandma thing to do.
I know, it's like a super, but it would also creep me out because then I would just think about like uncooked chicken. That's weird. But goosebumps, yeah. I mean, you know, as a child, I was obsessed with sunsets. And actually, my songwriting started oftentimes as a kid by watching the sunset after school every day because it was right outside my bedroom window. And there was something about that would always just, even though like the sun was going down, I would suddenly feel like all of this like really tense, hopeful emotion as a child. I don't know what that was about, but like, I guess that's like kind of an example. I would just like feel these chills and I feel like this like rise within me and like I would start writing as like a young kid. And it like also was this feeling of like, oh, this is like something that makes me feel the most alive. So like, I don't know. There's a starting point with my experience with Goosebumps. But also I didn't read the books, but I watched that TV show Goosebumps and I remember being quite scared. I remember there was like a dad stuck in the basement one time covered in green slime.
Yeah, green slime instead of blood.
Yeah.
You have a line in your bio, your Kathleen Parks bio. It says, for Kathleen, music is not about perfection, but feeling. What has it taken for you to get to that place with music and perfection?
Well, you know, okay. Going back to being a kid, I think everything is like reminding me of like what got me started and like what drove me into music. And I think as a kid violin player, I was studying classical music and there was this really like this huge emphasis on playing every note right and, you know, an exact certain way, and I couldn't connect to that because I also couldn't figure out, you know, as a child, you're like, sometimes you're put into whether it's like music or dance or sports or like something, and it's not always your choice. And for me, it was like starting with classical violin, and I was like, oh, I like music, but I don't. This isn't what people are playing. Like, I don't see people, like, blasting classical music on the street and getting down, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I couldn't, like, it wasn't until I found, like, fiddle music that I was, like, I'm from a very Irish family and I grew up Irish step dancing. And that was something I had a real love for. And so it wasn't until I found, like, a connection that I was, like, oh, okay, I get it. I understand. Like, why I love this or like what makes me want to play it. And you know, even when I was studying in music school, you know, you're like, you're surrounded by so many amazingly talented people. And you're like, oh my God, like, how am I even like here with these amazing, amazing players and singers and writers? And you're like, am I ever going to be good enough to do what I love? And at some point, you know, you have to keep going, keep trying, doing your best. But then there's also this shift where you, maybe the cracks are okay. Maybe people relate to that more. Because nobody is a perfect human and nobody is a perfect player. At least it's like how you think about yourself. Like you could listen to someone and be like, oh my God, every note they play is perfect. But if you were in their head, like maybe they're like thinking the opposite. Or maybe they're like really settled and within themselves and like feel like, yeah, I'm a badass.
You were born and raised in New York's Hudson Valley with very creative and artistic parents. Your dad, a professional musician, trumpet player, and music teacher, and your mom was a dancer. You were inspired to pursue both of their passions, which I like definitely want to explore. But first, can you set the scene for what growing up in your house looked like, and especially how music and art was treated?
Yeah. It was a really, really nice, welcoming atmosphere in regards to like music, art, dance, just anything, any like creative passion that we had as kids, me and my brother. I have one older sibling. And we both did Irish step dancing, and our mom put us in dance classes like at a really early age, and you know, it was really fun. I always felt really connected to music and singing and dancing, and I'm trying to think. Yeah, my mom would like teach us dancing like in our kitchen while she made dinner a lot of nights.
What kind of dancing?
Honestly, she would go for anything. Like if she was playing like swing music, she would teach us like a simple swing step so that we could like do that. And even though I'm not going around doing that now, it was like a really fun way to, you know, start learning about dance at home with your family. And like oftentimes I feel like your family is like not, you're a little bit, it might be a little bit awkward, like to show that part of yourself with your own family, you know, like it was very welcoming, which was really, really nice to have that. But my dad was a professional trumpet player. And so he would be away most weekends. So I was used to him going away on tour a lot of weekends. And kind of would get a sense of like, oh, okay. So like, musicians, they work on the weekends. Like I get, okay, that's what happens, I guess. And you're not always able to make every like family function, but you can still be a functional family. So
that sounds like a motto.
I know. Yeah. I'm losing track of what I was telling you, but yeah, so there was that. There was like the Irish culture in our family. My grandparents were both from Ireland. So my mom's side of the family, some of those kids did Irish step dancing, and that's where my mom got that. And then she got really into Polish dancing when she was in her early 20s, and she met my dad at a polka festival. And she was in a dance troupe there, and he was performing on the stage. And yeah, that was how they met. So my brother and I would go to a lot of like the festivals that my dad would play. And eventually, as I got older, I was really showing my dad that I wanted to like follow in his footsteps, and I wanted to know what it was like to tour, and I was curious about the lifestyle. And he was like, well, if you're going to do it, you really have to love it. Like, you really have to love it because it's hard. And I was like, okay, let's see. But he actually was very encouraging, and he and my mom encouraged me to, like, try to perform as much as I could in a lot of different ways. And my dad got me playing with the band that he performed with to fill in on fiddle for some gigs that the fiddle player couldn't make. And that was a really, like, eye-opening experience for me, just playing my first couple of festivals and be like, whoa, this is, like, awesome.
Oh, my gosh. There's so much there, Kathleen. Let's break some of this down. So I want to hear about the Irish influence in for you. Like, how has being Irish evolved for you? Because you were saying that Irish culture was kind of around you all the time when you were growing up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, my grandmother was a huge influence on our family. And I didn't know my grandfather because he passed away when I was very young. I was like one year old. So I never got to know him. My brother knew him better. But my grandmother, she was like a firecracker. And she was really, really funny lady. She was someone that, like, would welcome everyone into her home and would, like, want, you know, as many people to come over to the house as much as, like, you know, everyone was invited. And with that came a lot of music. And she would, like, tell us about her cousins and her, you know, her family history and about how all of her family, a lot of them played music, and she would dance. So that's kind of like where my mom got the dancing from. My aunts and, you know, when you were at the house, you know, either they would be playing music, either like listening to like some of their favorite Irish musicians, or they would ask me to break out my fiddle and I would play for the family in like the living room, which was terrifying at first.
Are those some of your first live performances?
Yeah, those were some of my first like live performances, and just playing solo fiddle for like your whole family is a scary feeling when you're like 14. Even though I loved it, I was like, oh my God, this is horrifying. And but they would start dancing. And honestly, it was that connection that that made me feel connected to the music that I was playing. So it's like kind of going back to like, what do I feel connected to, and like what feels good, and like what's gonna relate to others, and how can I relate to others? And that kind of like started a little bit of that for me. And yeah, so that Irish influence definitely is still there. You can still hear it in my fiddle playing. So I hear from the bluegrassers every once in a while. But I don't think it'll ever really go away. But yeah, I mean, I think Irish music in general oftentimes like brings me home. It kind of like reminds me of like where I come from, and who I come from, and how there's so much to learn like from your own history there. So I think that inspires me still, even when I'm unsure of like what I might need to do next musically. Like sometimes I like go back to my early days of like learning the fiddle, and like I'll just like listen to some Irish music and I'll feel like that connection again and feel a bit at home, and like also be reminded that like music is for joy, you know, producing joy and like bringing happy times to the table and like creating your own joy and creating joy with others. So I think that's a little cool. bit of that.
Man. Again, so much to explore there. I want to come back to the connection that you feel about music. So there's another line. I really combed through your personal bio. It really gave me a lot of material to work with. So this line on your personal bio, connection to yourself is key to playing with others and moving an audience. So it was really cool to hear you talk about playing those Celtic tunes for your family and then them responding by being encouraging and dancing. And then you felt that connection. And another time you really felt connected to music is when you came across other like teenagers and peers who also played Celtic music. Mm-hmm. So in discovering that like connection is the key, how have you worked to connect to yourself? And then talk a little bit more about how finding other musical peers have impacted your ability to connect.
Yes. Okay. Sorry. I'm like taking the question and trying to let it sit in my brain.
So the main question is, how have you worked to connect to yourself? And how did finding other musical peers impact your ability to connect?
Okay. So the way I've worked to connect to myself. A key moment in my just like studying of music and, you know, just learning and growing is I was studying with these amazing country blues players from Newton, Mass. Paul Rochelle and Annie Raines. They're
hell yeah.
Oh, you know them?
Yeah.
Oh, sweet. I love them so much. They're like my mentors. They've had such a huge influence on actually this whole thing that we're talking about, like connection and like one thing that like Paul would really emphasize is be yourself. Always be yourself. And I used to like put a lot of pressure on myself with that. And I don't think it took me a while to understand what that meant until I just was like, oh, wait, that means like don't put pressure on yourself. Like you can just be who you are. And that's how you find the people that you're meant to work with, you're meant to be friends with. That's how you accept yourself, you know? Even though, like, that's not saying, like, don't grow or, like, don't, you know, make positive changes. 'Cause that's, like, a part of it. But also, so Paul Rochelle, yeah, he would say that a lot to me. And I'd be like, okay. And, like, the more I started to just try even to relax and do that with my playing and just like it, I feel like I started to really feel music differently, like in this new shift. I wasn't like a student anymore, even though I'm still a student of music, but I started not putting this like pressure on myself to be, I guess, perfect or to be what others expect me to be as a musician, or yeah, just to just like do what I really love, and that'll like guide me into finding, yeah, the people that I want to play with, work with, and be friends with. So then along with that, that's kind of how I've, you know, found my bandmates and found even like a lot of the new songs that I've written over the last, I feel like this is even like a recent thing that I've discovered, even though when I was learning this, it was maybe like 8 years ago. But I mean, that is kind of when I like first started working with Twisted Pine and like working with different projects and like started recording music. And like, I feel like because of that, it's helped me write the music that I guess that I'm meant to be writing. And And also, like, maybe write hard things, you know, like things that aren't easy to talk about, like sadness and depression and self-doubt. But also, like, yeah, just like falling in love and like just being what it really feels to like be alive as like a human. And it's not just one feeling. It's a whole spectrum, and finding the right words to like say that in a song is really difficult. But I feel like because I've tried to always be myself and like not be hard on myself for who I am or be embarrassed of who I am, I have found and made connections with people that I really, really deeply care about and, you know, love.
This seems like a good time to talk about something you and I have in common, and that is polka music. Your dad played in the Jimmy Sturr Orchestra for a long while. My dad has been a huge polka fan for most of his life. He is an accordion player. He plays many, many polkas. He goes to many polka festivals. He's
oh my God.
A couple of accordion bands. I asked him if he knew Jimmy's band, and this is what he said. Jimmy Sturr is the top polka band revered by all polka bands. He has had some TV shows. In some ways, he is trying to copy Lawrence Welk. That's from my dad.
Yeah.
I heard you talk about this first on Get Up in the Cool with Cameron DeWitt.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, oh, man, here we go. Let's talk about this. Finally, I can talk to someone who understands when your dad comes. You know when your dad comes home from church because the sound of polka blasting on the radio is in your driveway.
Oh, my God.
Dad's home from church. So, polka, it's a very misunderstood genre. So what do you think of polka and how, like, you actually played a little while in Jimmy's band, like you would sit in on the fiddle,
yeah,
and play some classic polka featuring fast raging fiddle. How has having this like polka foundation shaped your musicality?
Oh my God, that is so funny. Also, I cannot believe that your dad plays the accordion and is like a polka person. I love it.
Yeah, neither can I.
It's amazing. Yeah, nobody, I don't, like, so many people don't understand because it's like, you know, it's a scene that I think is starting to die out, unfortunately. But, like, unless it's, like, having a resurgence and I just don't know about it.
There are some young accordion players that my dad has sent to me. So I think it'll live on.
Okay. Oh, please. I hope so, because it's awesome. It's so fun. It's such a joyous situation to be in. I think, like, that music, it kind of was the first time before I found, like, this, before I found the bluegrass scene, I found the polka scene, which is funny. But the, hey, you know, their bass, the bass playing is all 1/5. So there's a connection right there.
All right.
The tunes, they're really fast. Fiddle tunes are fast. They're like really notey. It's like you got to be on your toes to stay up with them. Keep up with them, I mean. I guess like my first like kind of bluegrass fiddle tune that I ever learned was for the Jimmy Sturr Band. And it was the Orange Blossom Special. And that was the first time I ever played, like, oh, I'm playing a country fiddle, which in my teenage brain, I was like, oh, this is country fiddle playing, which is, like, not exactly. But but it is, you know, such a famous bluegrass fiddle tune, a show tune, more of a show tune, a showstopper.
Is that what a show tune is? Like a...
Well, that's not like a technical term at all, but like kind of it's like a showstopper in a way. Like, I think like Orange Blossom Special, it's not something you'd play in like a fiddle jam because it's just like, it's very like, oh, this is a soloist. Like, this is going to feature the fiddle player, like of whatever group you're playing with. So like Michael Cleveland and Flamekeeper, they do a crazy version of Orange Blossom Special, and nobody can play that tune like Michael Cleveland can.
For those listening who aren't aware, Michael Cleveland is a very virtuosic fiddle player that all the kids love.
Yes, exactly.
He's like the Chapel Roan of fiddlers.
I would say so. Yeah, I have a video of Michael Cleveland playing Orange Blossom Special. Actually, I think it was at Earl Scruggs Fest last year, not this year, but last year in 2023. And oh my God, they had the camera like zoomed right in on him, and he's a madman.
To hear you talk about your first performances at 14 years old playing for your family, I would imagine like playing in Jimmy's band was also one of your first early performances. So yes. How did that experience set the stage for your feelings and approach for live performance? And then like also like this could be a bigger question, but how has your dad impacted the way that you perform live?
Being in the Jimmy Sturr band, like, it was so, so, so kind of Jimmy Sturr to have me in that band at such a young age. Like, I think the first time I ever played fiddle with the band was, like, they used to have these Jimmy Sturr Christmas shows, and they would do, like, four of them, and they would be in, like, Scranton, Pennsylvania.
They're always in Scranton, or like Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Yeah, there
Frankenmuth, Michigan.
Yeah. It would be like the shows would happen either in Pennsylvania and then like upstate New York somewhere. There was usually four of them, and in that show, I would, with my brother and my two cousins, we would do like this Irish dancing feature because that was in the 90s. When Riverdance was really, really big and Lord of the Dance was really, really big and Michael Flatley was like the king of dance. So they would have like this little like Irish feature. And I'll have to send you a clip. There's a really funny clip of me dressed as a leprechaun, full beard. I'm like 4 years old.
Yeah, we need that.
Yeah. That was my start. That was like the earliest stage of me performing on the stage, was like doing these Christmas shows every year until I was about 14. And by the time I was like 14 years old, that was like when I first played the fiddle in that show. And I remember I had learned this like string of tunes from my favorite Celtic fiddler at the time, who was like a real boundary like jumper, Eileen Ivers. She had a huge influence on why I wanted to play the fiddle, why I wanted to like, you know, have a band. And yeah, Jimmy Sturr let me play these tunes with the band, and they like learned these Irish tunes, which were hard. I don't even like, they were awesome players. But yeah, that was like the start. And as soon as I just remember the heat from the stage lights in like the theater, and just feeling like I become like kind of a different person when I step onto the stage. Like, I love this feeling, and it feels like it's a feeling I always want to experience. And I feel connected to the stage and like performing to this audience that I can't see because it's so dark in the theater, but like feeling like I need to put out as much good energy as I can so that I can fill that to the back of the room. And I just remember having that feeling as a teenager, and be like, that's what I want to do. Like, that's, I want to have that feeling, and I want to write my own music, and then, you know, I want to do all those things.
Mm.
And my dad, as a performer, was fantastic trumpet player, just would produce such a, like, beautiful, crisp tone. And oftentimes he was a soloist with that band. And when he would step out front, man, like, he would make me cry as a little kid. I would cry sometimes listening to my dad play.
Oh,
because
wow.
He was so, I don't know. I know it sounds ridiculous, but but it was such a beautiful, like, angelic tone. And that really had a positive influence on me. I was like, wow, like, my dad, he's able to, like, get on that stage and, like, you know, really, like, almost call out to people that need some healing or, like, something. It's like a wild way to describe it, but I loved how he would do that. And then he'd come off the stage and he was just like, yeah, how's it going? Like, oh, thanks for coming to the show. I was like, Dad, you're so sweet. And you don't even realize how much of a awesome, awesome, like, person you are. And so that had a really big effect on me and his humbleness, you know, like, and he was also very, very encouraging of, like, you know, if you have a love for music, like, that's what's going to carry you through this life, is, like, doing what really makes you happy and, like, what really speaks to you. And it doesn't have to be music always, but whatever it is in this life, like, if you do that, like, that's where you'll find, like, your true happiness. And I was like, I've always tried to keep that really close to me with music, because it's, I mean, everybody knows, but it's really hard. So it's good to, like, have, I was very, very, very lucky to have someone, both my parents were so positive and supportive in that way, but also, like, reminded me to, like, try to always spread that to others, you know, because that's the most important thing. And that was, that really influenced me on what I'm trying to do.
So it seems like when you were playing, first playing Celtic music, you know, you're playing it for a little while and then you wanted to expand into, like, improvisation, and you called yourself a little bit of a daredevil on the traditional side of music, of Irish music. Tell me more about being a daredevil in music. Do you still feel like that?
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely have that, a little bit of daredevilness in me when it comes to music. And as a teenager, it was like me being emo by not playing tunes traditionally, like, quote unquote traditionally. And my teacher would get really mad because it was very much like all the students play these tunes, like, exactly like this. And every once in a while, I'd, like, I don't know, I would just, like, improvise a little bit over the tune. Like, yeah, it would drive him nuts, which sounds really, really funny to say now. But yeah, I was a bit of a daredevil in that way. I think now the way that I'm a daredevil is that I don't like to do the same thing or do things in the same way all the time. So now it's still in an improv way. So, like, I want each show to have its own specialty or, like, own little bit of magic, or I try to find ways to keep things fresh. I guess that's what it is. Now it's just, oh, I'm trying to ways to, like, keep the tunes, the songs fresh, and, like, what's, like, a new way I could improvise, or, like, what's some wild way I could, like, get into the audience and, like, connect with them and, like, kind of make them laugh, or, I don't know, shock them, maybe. Still figuring out how ways to do that.
Cool. In 2012, you started going to Berkeley. You had a full scholarship for violin performance and songwriting. And this is kind of like where the seeds of Twisted Pine started to take root. I wanted to hear in the Berkeley section of our interview, I actually wanted to hear about the origin story of your five-string fiddle. Like, how did you get your five-string? What's the difference from like a normal four-string? And then what do you like about it?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Because I know there's a good story.
Oh, yeah. There's a good story here. So let's see.
And really embellish. Tell us all the details.
Okay. Really embellish. Sure. So I had, it was my second year at Berkeley. And I had done one semester with Daryl Anger in the spring, and he had a five-string fiddle, and I was like, whoa, what is that? Like, and he was explaining to me, you know, oh, well, you know, it has one extra string. It's the same range as a viola and a violin put together. So it has a lower string, so the lowest string on a viola. So it has a C string, and it's C, G, D, A, all the way up to E, your open E. So, and I was like, whoa, and the way he would play it when, because we would, he would teach me tunes and then we would play them together and he'd show me how to back them up. But he had such a bigger range because he had this really deep, dark tone because of this lower string. And I was like, oh man, that is just so cool. Like, it's almost like you can be a bass player in some ways or a cellist. And so that summer, I was obsessed with bluegrass. I was, like, practicing, like, 6 hours a day. I got really bad tendonitis in my left hand. and
time for physical therapy.
Yeah, yeah, I had to go to physical therapy, but I got better. And then the following fall, I had Daryl again. And I walked into his room, and he was like, hey, I got this five string. My friend, Gary Bartig, he made this and it's from Minneapolis. And, you know, he wants me to shop it around a few people. And I was like, oh, really? He's like, why don't you take this for a little bit? Why don't you take it for 2 weeks? And I was like, what? You want me to take this? And he was like, yeah, just take it for a few weeks. See if you like it. And, you know, just bring it back and I'll give it to someone else. And the 2 weeks went by, and he was like, oh, how are you liking the fiddle? And I was like, oh, I really, really like it. And he's like, oh, I'll let you keep it a little longer. And I was like, okay. And I kept it. And then after a month, he's like, hey, I'm going to need that fiddle back. Like, and I was like, oh, you do? And I was like, do you know how much it is? And he was like, yeah. Let me get in touch with Gary and find out. And basically, I called my parents because it was so shocking at how much less the price was from my violin that we thought it was going to be like, I don't know, $15,000 because it's such a nice violin. And, you know, violins, like, you own one. You own one. This is different than like guitars and like other. I don't know how everybody like buys a bunch of instruments, but in the violin world, it's just known that you buy one and you have that for a really long time until you sell that and then you get a different one. And this one was like, I think at the time it was $2,000. And I was like, what? I could make that happen. Like, I've been gigging. I was like gigging all summer and I like asked my dad if he could like help out a little bit and
play a couple extra polka gigs.
Yeah. I was like, Dad, I love this fiddle like so much. And he was like, why don't we treat it as like that's your Christmas gift? And I was like, oh my God. And I like bought the fiddle and I play it to this day. I've had it for 11 years now. And it's, That is the love of my life, that fiddle, by Gary Bartig.
And listeners, if you have not listened to Daryl Anger and Bruce Molsky, we're just on Basic Folk recently talking about their new record and their like epic bestie friendship.
Aww.
You should check it out, Kathleen, if you haven't heard it.
Yes.
It's so funny.
I'm going to listen to that next. Yeah.
Okay, here is some Twisted Pine history. Twisted Pine came to be from meeting each other in Boston through different friend groups. You all kind of like met at parties. You started jamming together. You got a residency at the Cantab Lounge. For those who are not familiar, let me describe the Cantab Lounge. It is a dive bar in Central Square, Cambridge, Massachusetts, just outside of Boston. I used to go there quite a bit for the Bluegrass Night that's hosted by Jeff Muldar, right?
Jeff Bartley.
Jeff Bartley. Don't tell him that I confused him with Jeff Muldar.
Good.
Oh, God. A folk faux pas. So it's kind of like, is such a dive. Like the floor, I remember, was like cracked Czech linoleum.
Yeah.
It kind of always smelled like the that like bathroom soap, like that like urinal cake kind of smell on the first floor.
Oh my god.
And then in the basement there was another theater, which was actually like a little bit nicer, that I saw a lot of like improv comedy. So it's like kind of like a catch-all for entertainment, but it is noted for its bluegrass origins. So Twisted Pine got a residency at the Cantab. How did that gig, that reoccurring gig, help solidify the band?
Yeah, that gig, that was such a special time for the band because, yeah, it kind of helped us start our weekly rehearsals. It was like, oh, we have this gig. It's on Tuesday. It's like the Bluegrass Night. And like we're doing the opening slot for whatever band is coming up after that. And we just kind of like got to it. We were like, let's do this. Let's like try to get a following that's from this crowd and like see what we can do. And it was kind of a hilarious, really chaotic, like, you know, this is like classic bluegrass, students of bluegrass, young kids, like playing as fast as they can, singing as loud as they can, and like just balls to the wall, just like just like going so hard. And but it was also, it was so much fun. It was such a fun time. And yeah, it really like got us thinking of ourselves as like a unit, and like we're a band, and like this is what we're doing. And at that time we were just playing traditional bluegrass music. It was very wild traditional bluegrass music, but it was traditional, which is so far from where we are now. But looking back, it was definitely what helped me become, it was just like the foundation of performing that I needed at the time, just to like, how do you even do that? And at the time I wasn't even singing lead vocals. I was just learning backup harmonies. So it was like the first time I was even singing too.
So the lineup for Twisted Pine, you're on fiddle and lead vocals.
Mm-hmm.
Dan Bowie is on mandolin, Chris Sartori on bass, Anne Fung on flute. Everybody sings. I have a question about Rachel Sumner.
Yeah.
So Rachel is a good buddy of mine. So I wanted to include her on this interview.
Yeah.
So did she leave the band in 2018 or 2019?
2019. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Rachel left, Anne joined.
Mm-hmm.
Rachel was a songwriter, singer, and guitar player. Anne is a singer and a flute player. So pretty different.
Yeah.
What was that transition like for you? Like being able to part ways with Rachel, you remain friends to this day, as well as like welcome Anne as a new member and fit into like the fold of the already established band?
Yeah, you know, that was an interesting time because we were unsure, you know, because Rachel, you know, those were big shoes to fill. You know, she's a badass and an amazing songwriter and singer. And it was kind of like, wow, what are we going to do now? Who could we possibly get? Are we going to get another guitar player? I guess. Like, we just had no idea. But we just happened to run into Anne at Folk Alliance in 2019. And we saw her and we were like, hey, like, we need someone to sit in. Do you want to sit in on some of our showcases? And she was like, sure, I'll do that. And she sat in and it was just like a very natural fit. It was like completely different sound. But we were like, oh, this is fun. Like, this could work because we're like, you know, we're still playing. Well, at least the portion of the songs that I had written, we were playing those and finding covers that could like work with flute. And just the groove changed because now it's like all like almost like lead instruments and bass trying to create this like rhythmic machine. So we kind of turned into like a percussive and like rhythmic machine, which was fun. And it, you know, it was just like a completely different sound. And I still really love listening to like that other side of Twisted Pine when Rachel was with us. I love hearing those songs and I love hearing how it's changed over time. And it kind of was, even though visually people were like, there's no guitar, we were like, the sound kind of had this nice little, just like kind of like a seamless transition. In just like a way of just like, oh, we're just like growing, our sound is changing, it's growing, but it wasn't like shocking. It wasn't like, whoa. I don't know how other people think when they like hear it, but to me it's just still like music. and if you just like, if you have like the right ears on, you'll just be like, oh, I get it, you know? And hopefully people do get it, even though it's like kind of out, I guess. But yeah, I don't know. It was an interesting time trying to figure out what was going to come after that because we just had no idea. We were just like, I have no idea. But
was it hard to, like transition from having Rachel as a bandmate to just being friends?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, because we missed her. You know, we missed her a lot on the, like, playing, you know, on the road. It's, you have to, like, learn how to tour together. And, you know, we had been together since the very, very beginning. So we had grown a lot together. And so, yeah, I think it's always, it's really hard when someone leaves a band situation, you know, and you're still friends and you want the absolute best for them because you know they're going to do awesome things, but you like, you're going to miss the old times, you know, but then, you know, we found Anne at like the right time, which was good. That really lucked out because we had no idea. We were playing as a trio for a little bit and we're kind of like, okay, like, let's just see what happens. And that's kind of Twisted Pine in one sentence. Let's see what happens. I feel like that's been our motto like all these years because we're writing songs, we're recording albums, and we're like, well, let's see how it goes. Let's just get a takedown and see if we like it. And if we don't, we'll move on to the next song. And you know what I mean? Like, and that's sometimes what gigs are like. You're like, well, look at this beautiful room we're going to play tonight. Let's see how it goes. Hopefully this crowd likes us and they don't throw tomatoes.
After Rachel left, did you became like the de facto lead vocalist,
mm-hmm.
which must have been huge. Like, let's talk about your voice. Like, you get complimented on your singing voice a lot. Because it is, like, very unique, and you have, like, a ton of emotional range with it. And also something cool that I noticed, it's also, like, pretty similar to your speaking voice, which is, like, not always the case.
Oh,
cool. I remember, like, watching The Simpsons and Billy Corgi. It was before, like, the internet was a thing. Like, watching The Simpsons in the 90s and Billy Corgan was on. And his speaking voice is so different from his singing voice, but yours is like, it just seems like very in line. So,
oh, well, thank you.
What has been your relationship to both your speaking voice and your singing voice?
Oh, man. You know, I've always hated my speaking voice, but I know that it is higher than most voices. But I have learned to accept myself. Wow, this is sounding really ridiculous right now. You know, Ella Fitzgerald is one of my big vocal heroes. And only, like, within the last few years did I hear her speak in, like, because I started checking out interviews. She also has a really high speaking voice. And that took me by surprise, big time. I was like, what? And then another one of my heroes, Shania Twain, also her speaking voice took me by surprise because her voice is, when she sings, it's a little bit lower and it's a little bit wider in tone. I don't really know how to explain that.
That was good.
Yeah. Oh, okay, good. And then when she's...
It's, like, rich.
Yeah, yeah, it's very rich. But it also, like, I don't want to say pierces. It, like, really, like, punches through, which is why I think she's able to soar the way she does.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I heard her speak for the first time, I was like, oh, whoa. She also, her voice naturally sits a little bit higher than how she sings. For me, my voice started, for singing, not just speaking, it started a lot higher, a lot wispier. When I first started singing, I tried to do the Alison Krauss sound, and I tried to be a little bit more bluegrass. And over the years, I found, which I'm glad that you, thank you for saying that, my speaking voice and my singing sound similar, because I think that's sometimes hard to do. When you're first learning to sing, you're like, how do I be myself? How do I sound like myself? And sometimes...
It's what Paul Rochelle was talking about.
Yes. Yes, it all goes back to that. Yeah. Since I started, actually, and I noticed this especially on this brand new Twisted Pine album, and actually my first solo record I put out, my voice has lowered in the last 2 years, and I've kind of, when I sing, depends on the day when I talk, but in general, my range has gotten actually quite a bit deeper, and it's stretched even more, which I was shocked about. And actually, it kind of scared me at first, because at first I'd wake up and I'd be like, hey, how's it going? And I'd be like, wait, who was that? Is that like a different me in there? But I don't know. I accept all of them. They're all like characters, I guess.
I have to say, I really like your speaking voice because I have like a little bit of hearing loss, except the where your voice sits.
Oh,
in the octaves, like I can really hear it.
Oh, really? Oh, well, that's good.
Yeah.
I'm glad that it's beneficial in that way.
If you and I were at like a concert in between sets and people are all chatting and chatting, chatting, I could hear your voice over everyone's.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. Well, thanks.
My dad is the opposite hearing loss.
Oh, he does.
Yeah, if you wanted to talk to him, which maybe you do because he loves polka so much, you'd have to talk down like this so
okay.
He could hear you.
Yeah.
Yeah, he can hear my voice really well.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Thanks for talking about speaking voices with me. That's so cool.
Yes, of course.
The new album is Love Your Mind, and it seems like Twisted Pine is at its funniest. Like, you all seem like pretty funny people in real life. I've met you all in real life. Actually, I don't know, Kathleen, if we've met in person, but I've definitely met Dan, and Dan had comedy vibes. You have been working to bring humor into the band, so how has that evolved for Twisted Pine?
Bringing humor into the band. Well, let's see. I think some of it, you know, I guess a little bit of that, like we started bringing that in on our last record, which is called Right Now. We made a video for one of our instrumentals. It's like a funk instrumental that Dan wrote, and it's called Amadeus Party. And for the video, we rented like 1700s style costumes, and we got really tall wigs. Anne's wearing like a hot pink wig, I'm wearing like a white one, and it's gigantic. And we wore like these huge ball gowns. The dudes are wearing like, you know, they really do look like the movie Amadeus. Have you seen that movie?
Oh, hell yeah, that's a great movie. A great film.
It is a great film. We all love that film so much. And so we always like are just quoting it. And we quote a lot of movies. But that one in particular, we were like, we got to call this Amadeus Party. Because it ended up somehow getting sung in the song. In the B section. Or C section, the bridge. And so anyway, we first did that. We filmed that. We just had like a blast rocking out in these costumes to this really, really funky Mando tune. And I feel like that was like the start of us being like, you know what? We like to laugh. We like to joke all the time. Like, why don't we just allow that to be part of our band and our even our music? And so like on this record, I feel like the lyrics to After Midnight, Nothing Good Happens, we got really silly in that song because it's kind of like this classic country song, but it's about like the ridiculousness of being at a music festival and staying up late, camping, and like, you know, the things that happen that you don't realize. Which are like, you know, when everyone's slapping at the mosquitoes at their ankles? That's such an annoying feeling. And I don't know. Stuff like that, we like, when we were writing that song, we were throwing out some ridiculous lyrics that didn't make the final cut, but we left the best ones and the most family-friendly ones in the song.
Yeah, so from that song and that video, After Midnight, Nothing Good Happens, which is on the new album, I really got a sense of, like, how hard it is to take care of your, like, physical and mental health, like, while you're at a music festival or while you're on tour with the band. So what has healthy touring looked like for you since the band started, and as you all get older and wiser, how does it look now?
Ooh, okay, yeah. When we first started touring, oh my gosh, I was not eating my vegetables. And I'm still working on this, but I had no type of like exercise routine happening at all, and I still need to I feel like that's going to be my whole life, is working on an exercise routine that works for me.
Oh, you got to do it now. You got to build it up, build up your endurance so that you can hang on to it for the rest of your life. This is a good time to do it.
Yeah, exactly. So I feel like when we first started touring, we were like really killing ourselves and also like, you know, still killing ourselves. But but we like didn't understand how much maybe we should have like 2-day break after like a 4-day run of shows, like 1 or 2 days, like if we can, because 4 shows in a row is like hard on your body. And you're traveling between all those shows. Now we try to like have a few day break whenever we can, if we can like financially make that happen, like in a reasonable way, because it's just better for everybody's like mental state. We also, as a band, really try to eat well. Like, actually, our favorite band food is poke. That's like what we all unite on. So as soon, most times when we land at the airport, we leave the airport after picking up the rental car, and then we're like, all right, did anybody find a poke spot? Because it's like everything, we can all eat poke because we also have like food allergies. Everyone can eat poke and everybody's happy when they eat it. So we're eating more fish, we're eating our veggies, and I try to walk when we're like stopping at a rest stop. I try to like get out of the car when I can and like either do some squats or like walk around a bunch. It's just these little things that we've tried to learn over time.
Totally. Lone Star. Mm-hmm. This song is fucked. It is a wild song. It's like 6.5 minutes long. It's like 3 or 4 songs in one. You started writing Lone Star 10 years ago. The mm-hmm. band wrote some of it, and then you guys decided to put it in the vault. And now that the band's been around for a decade, you say, we were ready to write the rest of it. So what did the act of taking 10 years to write a song teach you about like finishing something or reaching a milestone in your own time versus like what might be like expected of you?
When I wrote the tune and I brought it to the band and we started writing some lyrics, it felt like a song, you know, at the time. We're like, this is an epic song. Like, this could be an epic song. But at the time, we were really going for this old school bluegrass thing. And in my younger self was like, I don't know. We're such like a young band. like, it feels weird. Like, I don't even know, like, who is going to sing the... It was even a question of who's going to sing the song, like, in the band, because there were, like, mm-hmm. 3 writers happening. And so we just, like, put it in the vault. I was just like, I'm not sure about this. And then, you know, this album came around, and Dan and I actually started talking about it. He's like, remember Lone Star? And I was like, oh my god, yes, I do remember Lone Star. And like, what are we gonna do with that? And all we had was like this A section that we're singing, which were the I'm going to heaven on a Greyhound bus. And I was like, whoa, I feel like after all this time of touring, I kind of relate to the song a little bit more. Like, it feels like the tiredness, the exhaustion of like being out on the road, or like sometimes just like the heaviness of like a gig not feeling good, or just, you know, when you run out of steam, you know, like you just really gotta refuel. Mm-hmm. You gotta refuel your soul. And sometimes that means you need to be alone for a bit. Maybe it means you need to take a little break from the tour life. And so looking at it more in that way, it was like, oh, this is cool. Like, because I feel like, especially coming out of the last 4 years, like, everything is so heavy. The music scene is so crappy.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is. And it's just... We're living in like such a weird climate, like literally weird climate, but like also just as human beings, we're like, what are we gonna do? Like, where are we supposed to go? Like, what are we supposed to be doing? And I think musicians and artists of all types are also feeling that in this other way, because they're like, this industry is constantly changing. I feel like I don't know how to play the game. So In some ways, it still has the most old school bluegrass, like, you know what? I'm getting out of here. Screw all of y'all. I'm doing my thing and I'm sticking to it. And I guess I'm going to heaven on a Greyhound bus, and you can join me if you want. But either way, I'm going to do this my own way, which sounds like something like an old man would say right before he's about to die. But also, like, I don't know, something about it. It, like, when I sing that song live, I feel like I'm channeling this like turbulence of like, or I'm trying to think about all the hard things and trying to like shoot them like out into space of like, rejection, things will be better. Sorry, it sounds ridiculous, but I don't know.
No, I feel like the way you explained it feels exactly how the song is.
Oh, cool. Well, thanks.
Which is totally fucked.
Yeah.
That song.
It is.
Very epic.
Well, thank you.
All right, one more question, and yeah. I apologize. I had a question about your solo record, but I want to wrap this up, but I do want you to know that I know that you put a solo record out in August called Rolling Down the Line.
Yeah.
And it's lovely.
Thank you.
So one more question about Twisted Pine, and then, Kathleen, we will do the lightning round.
Okay.
This is a question about the image of Twisted Pine. So there have been like more and more creative, artistic, and fashion-forward visuals of the band and like your album covers and your press photos in the past few years. And you are kind of like, I mean, not really, but you are kind of like the de facto center, like being the lead singer of the band. How do you feel about the like visual aesthetic of Twisted Pine? And how do you feel about like being the center of that visual?
Ooh, hard question. At least for me, I think this is a hard question. The visual aesthetic of the band. It's funny because we were talking about like how our humor has come through the music, and like visually, I think we try to drive, like with our album covers anyway, we try to drive the like badassery that we feel about our own music, which I don't mean to come across as, I guess I don't mean that in a boastful way. I just mean, like, you put in so much time and effort into writing and recording, and, like, you work really hard to make the sound, like, as epic as you can, to, like, cut through the airwaves of, like, I hope this can reach whoever it needs to reach, and they can like feel the groove and like feel the power that we're trying to deliver through the airwaves. And I think visually with our album covers, we've also tried to do that. And on stage, yeah, we like coordinate. We try to, you know, try to link up. It's interesting because I feel like bands that are maybe have more money behind them, either like people are funding the band or like however it's happening, they're able to travel with almost like a look, like the stage costumes. And for us, we're still like, what can we fit in our luggage that won't wrinkle like terribly and still fit our gear? You know, we're like still in that stage, but we're still like working on like bringing that badassery to the stage. So I don't know. It's interesting trying to like travel with all that stuff. But as far as like being the center of that visual, I'm happy to carry the torch in some ways. I feel like on the Right Now record, I'm holding my fiddle and like holding this pearl, and it almost feels like a sure. I'm going to stand tall and like push forward the vocal of this band and like try to deliver the words and melodies that we all like work hard to bring to the table. And sorry, this is funny.
Sure, I'll do it, guys.
Yeah. I think I just kind of like, sure. I mean, I've always been like inspired by like movies from the 1940s and like beautiful stage actresses like Betty Davis and like Judy Garland is one of my heroes. And like, so I think like as a vocalist in some ways, I feel like that, yeah, like Broadway vibes, like spotlight vibes, you know, like I try to be like badass in that way. Even though when you talk to me, I'm like pretty shy. So I don't know. I guess that's my theory on taking up that torch a little bit.
Oh man, I feel like we could talk for a long time about just that topic. But Kathleen, we have to do the lightning round.
Okay, lightning round. I'm excited and scared.
Good. Here we go. Who is the hardest working musician in the polka band?
Ooh, I think the accordion player.
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah. Agree. Okay, this is a yes or no question. Are you on the dance floor at the wedding?
Yes, definitely.
What is a song that would get you off the dance floor?
All by Myself.
What are you drinking before and then after the gig?
Ooh, tequila before and a vodka seltzer after.
All right. Who is your celebrity crush?
Ooh, my celebrity crush? Oh, come on. Okay, I'll just tell you who I had a crush on when I was a teenager. Michael Bublé. And right now it's probably Timothée Chalamet, honestly. Except I think he's in too many movies. I just want to say that.
Okay, he needs to cool it.
I think he needs to cool it.
Your boyfriend Timothée Chalamet needs to cool it. This is the last one. What time are you going to bed at the fiddle camp?
Oh, dang. You know, it used to be like 2:30. Now it's like 12:30. Sorry, guys. Mm.
Yeah. That's how daylight savings time. Each year you get older, you lose a half hour.
Oh, my God. Hey, all sons need a break.
Kathleen, thank you so much for talking to me. It's been really wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been so much fun.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by Anthony Cabrera. Alex Stanton composes our music. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. You can find all of our episodes there, wherever you get podcasts. You can check us out on FolkAlley.com or Folk Alley's mobile app. You can search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app, or you can go to our website, basicfolk.com. If you enjoyed this episode, we suggest sharing it with a friend, like maybe one of your friends that decided that they wanted to pick up the accordion, but then it's actually like a really hard instrument to play, so they stopped playing it, but they still have 5 accordions in their house anyways. Send this episode to your friend who has 5 accordions. they will love it. All right. Thanks for listening all the way to the end. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.